Hello everyone, welcome to another episode of the Total Football Analysis Premier League Analysis Podcast, where we, as the name suggests, analyze anything and everything that is to do with the English Premier League. And before we get into the nitty-gritties of what we're covering this episode and who my guest is and all of that, just a quick sort of message to everyone that hope, wherever you're listening from, hope that you're safe in the midst of this sort of coronavirus outbreak. Hopefully all of y'all are following the government directives that are there in your area. You know, stay inside, try and avoid contact with people as much as possible. Wash your hands, and as the new buzzword says, social distancing. So just sort of stay away from people's and sort of public gatherings so that we can get through this period as soon as possible. And yeah, just hopefully everybody can get through this safely and quickly, and we can avoid as many casualties and as many as much sort of illness as much as we can. While obviously everybody is going to be stuck at home, and there is a question of what you're going to do to pass the time, so I think our podcast and the content we put out on our website is one of the best ways you can pass your time, especially if you are interested in the analysis side of football content. So we are on Twitter at Total Analysis is the handle, and the website is www.totalfootballanalysis.com, where even though, you know, football has stopped for the foreseeable future, we have not stopped with regard to the content we produce. There are multiple pieces being published on the website on a daily basis, even though football has stopped, because there is always something or the other to analyze. There's always something to compare, some sort of data to look at and draw conclusions from. So we have a lot of pieces coming out every day, and this is going to be the case in the weeks going forward as well, even though we don't really have any matches to cover. So do go onto the website, check out our content, let us know if you like it on Twitter. And obviously do check out the podcast as well, because we don't just cover the Premier League. We cover women's football, the Bundesliga, La Liga, and there is a sort of analysis podcast in general as well, where we have the head of our group, Chris, and the lead sort of analyst, Lee, who get on and they talk about tactical concepts and themes and all of that on a general basis. We here, obviously, as I said earlier, look at the Premier League, and as listeners would know, we were covering the relegation threatened sides in the Premier League. That's what we did in the last week, and we're looking at three of the teams this week as well. And to help me with that, I have got the head or the lead of the sort of women's football side of things at Total Football Analysis here, but obviously he does watch a bunch of Premier League football as well. It is Abdullah. So hey Abdullah, how's it going?
Yeah, man, it's all good. Yeah, great introduction, and I echo the sentiments that you're giving everybody else. But appreciate the intro, and yeah, it's a you know, we're all quarantined, sitting up at home. So, what else better to do other than, you know, working from home during the day, and then just, you know, get straight onto the football stuff in the evening, kind of keep getting the content out that we've been talking about.
Yeah, exactly. That best of both worlds, but it does allow you to do a lot more than one would possibly do on a normal day. So in that sense, yeah, absolutely. We're actually quite excited about the fact that most of our content creators and everybody has a lot more time to get their content out. But yeah, coming back to the subject of this week's podcast, we are looking at, as I said earlier, we're looking at the relegation battle in the Premier League, and we'd covered three of the sides in the previous episode, which were Watford, Brighton, and Norwich City. And we are looking at the remaining three sides. So there are basically six sides. If you look at the table, six sides who could potentially go down this season. So the other three sides, which are Newcastle United, Aston Villa, and Bournemouth, are what we will cover in this week's episode. Basically, we're looking at their tactics, how they've played this season, and whether we feel they have a chance at surviving or whether they will sort of go down. So without further ado, we will move on to the first team that we're looking at this on this episode, which is Newcastle United. So Abdullah, what do you think about their tactics and how they've played this season?
So Newcastle. Where do you start with Newcastle? They're an enigma of a team. Like, they've got so many pretty, I'd say so many. They've got some decent players. Like, it's not like they don't have the players. They've, in some key positions, they've got some really good players. It's just, you know, I mean they've got two fundamental problems, which at the end of the day is the, you know, the main issue with what, you know, most teams need to fix. It's scoring goals and keeping them out. Like, Newcastle are, you know, they've improved. You know, obviously my last stint on this show talked about Newcastle as well, and kind of we were looking forward to the season and how they would do. And currently, you know, I'm back on Newcastle, and kind of the difference between then and now, is that they've improved from an attacking sense. And when I say that, I mean that, well, obviously they're now 13th in the table. They are on 35 points, and they are about, you know, they're about five or seven, you know, three, 8 points away from the relegation side. So 8 point is a healthy gap. Not obviously not the biggest gap in the world, because we know how quickly the league can change, but you know, it's a decent gap considering they were more near the relegation, you know, sides earlier in the season. Now, they have improved, like I said, they've improved from an attacking sense. The biggest difference has been Alain Saint-Maximin and Miguel Almiron have kind of just, you know, finally gotten used to the league. You know, gotten run, you know, a run of games in the side, and they finally settled into life in the Premier League and Newcastle. And I think that the team has finally settled into Steve Bruce's tactics. You know, his five man back line has improved. I think the January transfer window helped as well, obviously with the signings, which we'll come up with, you know, a bit later. But you know, playing their 5-4-1-3-5-2 formation has kind of helped. Everybody's kind of gotten used to it. And you know, the two wide players, like we said, Saint-Maximin and Almiron, they've kind of come good. You know, like if I look at both of their if I look at their stats, specifically, let's start with Saint-Maximin. He's got he takes I mean, for a side that Newcastle that really counterattacks, that really don't have possession of the ball, he has about 2.5 shots, you know, per game, but more than half of them are on target, which is great. I mean, sure, you want more shots, but then the shots, you'd rather have quality shots than than shots off target. So would you rather have nine shots and none on target, or 4 shots and 4 on target? You know, you obviously take it from there. So and he's doing well in that regard. He has about 11.57 dribbles per 90 minutes, with about a 61% success rate, which, again, it's one of his strengths. He's really, really good at dribbling. So, you know, he's finally being almost afforded the space that he needs, and this is a testament to the players, like I said, getting used to the formation and the system. They're able to counterattack better, more, you know, they're able to find the spaces, and they're able to dispossess the players, the opposition team, deeper in their side, and allowing the likes of Saint-Maximin and Almiron to kind of find the spaces in behind and kind of open up their legs and just run, you know, run with the ball. And you know, and that also shows in his progressive runs for 90 minutes. He's taken about 4.31. And he isn't, and he isn't, it's not like he's not working hard. He's got about 20-21 offensive duels with about a 50% win rate. So he is putting in the work. He's putting in the work, in a off the ball and on the ball capacity, which I think has been great. And then a lot of he's almost like the Adama Traore for Newcastle. The effect that Adama Traore has had for Wolves, he's kind of having, maybe not to the same effect, but he's kind of like there. He's become, you know, he's this really quick, pacey, you know, tricky winger who can get past players. And on his day, he's almost unplayable. You know, he kind of, you know, he's. He's and he's kind of what, you know, he's kind of what Newcastle needs. I think Newcastle in the beginning, you know, when he had come in, he was just kind of off the ball a bit. He had to get, you know, used to the Premier League, and you know, Newcastle were kind of really slow in transition. Now they're a lot quicker with these two, and these two, you know, are finding the back of the net. It makes sense. Now, if we look at Miguel Almiron, while he is another pacey player who likes to play on the counterattack as well. He's a bit more direct in the sense where he likes to take the ball onto long strides and then get crosses in or get on the ends of 1-2 exchanges. Whereas Maxima is a bit, while he does run fast, he runs at players, he likes the ball at his feet more. But what I like about Miguel Almiron is he will run with the ball, but then he'll lay it off to someone, say, on an inside channel, and he will continue his run to either get on the end of it, of that pass to get a cross in, or get in the box to kind of take a shot in. So he's kind of being able to do both, whereas Saint-Maximin has been a bit more of a provider. And again, like you said, he's been scoring a bit more goals. And we can see with Miguel Almiron's stats, we can see here again, 4.35 dribbles per 90 minutes, 53% success rate. He's not has as many progressive runs with the ball because, like I said, like he likes giving it away and making those off the ball runs. So he's had about 2.3 progressive runs per 90 minutes. He's only had about 2 touches in the box. And he has 10 offensive duels per 90 minutes. So he's doing some ball, work off the ball. But, and his shots on target isn't the best. He's at 1.82 per 90 and 37, shots on target. But I think that to me, the stats here for Almiron are a bit skewed because in recent games, he's been a lot better in terms of his overall play. So, and again, you've got the issue with Joelinton, or I don't know how I've heard it, different pronunciations of his name. But he's kind of doing his bit now. He's playing a bit more as a target man, and I think a lot of the reason why Almiron and Saint-Maximin are able to do their work is I think because Joelinton is able to get into the game a little bit more, and he's able to play those guys in and kind of take care of defenders. The game against Rochdale, the game against Oxford United, they kind of showcased, while they are lesser opposition, quote unquote, it did show the qualities that the front three can have when and if they're playing, if they're playing well. Looking at Miguel Almiron's stats for the Premier League, I mean, he's had 28 games and 2 goals and 1 assist, but those 2 goals have kind of come in the last couple of games along with that assist. So he is coming into a stride. It's unfortunate that the league has to stop and be suspended, so he can't continue his run of form. And obviously that comes with playing more games, but I think he's a good buy, and I think he will eventually come good for the team. And same with Maxima. He's got 2 goals and an assist in the Premier League, but he is just having an overall impact on the team, and he's slowly but surely becoming their, I would say he's becoming their focal point from an attacking perspective. From a, and one more point I'd like to bring up about the attacking content is that they have, Newcastle have scored, from the last stats that I was looking at, they've scored about 24 goals, in total, right? Sorry, 25 goals. And the funny thing is that the split comes from 12 from open play, 12 from set pieces, and 1 from counterattack. So, if we're looking at those numbers, like we said, there's only 4 goals and 2 assists between the two wingers, and Joelinton has a goal. Where are the rest of the goals coming from? Well, a lot of them are coming from individual players, but a lot of them are coming from the defenders. A lot of their defenders have a lot of goals, and this is why we see that set pieces play a huge role in the way Newcastle are moving forward. Against Chelsea, we saw the last minute Isaac Hayden scored from a set piece. And we've seen it from many, many other games. And if we look at it, they do a lot of their work from that. So it's not the most effective thing to rely on set pieces, but when it is something that works, I guess, if you're Newcastle, you keep doing it. And, until either, the tactics change or they kind of get some, and I think players have to get into form. I think Joelinton needs to, I think it's more the system's fault than his fault, but I think Steve Bruce needs to move away from this 5-3-2 formation. I think he needs to play a little bit. I know he can't do it this season. I would do it next season if they were to survive, but he needs to get in some players that can play a bit better, on the ball. I think they've got a good defender in Jamal Lascelles. I think they need to, I think they need to find Jhonder Shelvey has his days, but he's just not disciplined enough, and he's not as consistent. He's got a few disciplinary issues, as we've seen. I think he needs to find a. I think he needs to find a. I think he needs to find a spine. He needs a new central midfielder. I think just get somebody in there and change that up. And I think he needs to get Joe Linton firing, or he needs to buy a new striker. I think that's the name of the game. From a defensive point of view, it's the same old thing. I mean, defensive organization has been the problem. If I was looking at a few clips just before, it doesn't give me. I was looking at a few clips and it gave me an idea that I was like, you know what? Is it about Newcastle that's the problem? They've got a couple of really good individual defenders in like Jamal Lascelles, like I said, but, and then they've got DeAndre Yedlin and players like that, and Jethro Willems. But I think their defensive organization from a shape perspective and just organization, it's just not there. A lot of the goals that they concede are sloppy. Like, I was just looking at some clips against Oxford United and it's almost a little bit ridiculous. Like, it was a lot of ping ponging going on. Players at the edge of the box weren't being closed down. And, you know, Oxford were able to score. Again, it just comes from a lot of sloppy defending. And we'll see this theme throughout the episode, at least with Bournemouth as well. Like, it's just very sloppy defending. And I think that's what's going to cost them if they can. Again, I was looking at another example is they are very sloppy in midfield and getting it out of defense. When the ball gets out of defense and goes into midfield, they lose it. Or there are some sloppy passes from the center backs to midfield. The opposition can intercept. Leicester scored both their goals through interceptions. Everton scored their goals against Newcastle, again, through interceptions higher up the pitch. So they're susceptible, if that's how you say the word, susceptible to high press. And they need to either play better out of the back, or they just need to play it simple and get the ball out and just kind of be aware of the surroundings and positioning. And I think that's their biggest issue. Can they survive? Well, they're getting results when they need it. So I can't even tell you that they couldn't continue doing it. But if they would, they definitely need to make some big changes in the summer.
What I mean, something that's interesting for me, at least when I've seen Newcastle, has been obviously everything that you've pointed out, but I think they've really struggled with creativity, as you said. Like, even if you look at even statistically, like if you just look at the expected goals tally, they've scored 25 goals, right? Their XG is at 26. So it's not like they've created chances and they're not taking them. They're literally not even creating chances. And they've scored the least number of goals in the league. They've scored just 25. And the fact that they're still 13th, is because of their defense, is because they've conceded, what, 40, 41 goals? Yeah. They've conceded 41 goals, which is less than everybody else that's below them in the table, I think. And it's allowed them to sort of ride out the fact that they're not scoring goals. And yeah, so only Brighton have conceded 40 goals, they're down in 15th. Newcastle have conceded 41, but that's it. Everybody else below them has conceded at least 4 goals more than them. Some have conceded like 10, 12. Like Southampton have conceded 12, 11 goals more than they have.
Yeah,
exactly. They've actually, if you were to compare, they've conceded 1 goal more than Burnley have, than Spurs have. So that just tells you. And they've just conceded 2 goals more than Chelsea have all season, you know? So that tells you that I think it's their defense that will probably keep them in the league this season. Even again, expected goals tells you the same story. They've conceded 41 goals, but their XG against is at 52. So they're outperforming it by 11 goals, which again, I think is close to the highest in the league. Sheffield United are the only other one, theirs is 11.9 or so, which is so close to 12, the XGA difference. But yeah, their defense is outperformed any other in the league, I think, in that sense.
Yeah.
And that's probably why they will stay in the league, but not from an attacking point
of view.
They have really struggled from an attacking point.
I definitely agree. Like you talked about XG, like they've overall as a team, they've only had 10.5 shots on target all season at a 34% success rate of being on target, which is poor. their opposition against them have had 13.5 at 36% of a success rate. So you could say that they're taking more shots against them, but they're limiting their opposition to only 36% on target, which in some sense is a credit to their defense for keeping out so much, but that's making Dubrovka, the goalkeeper, I can't pronounce the name right now, Dubrovka, he's doing more work than he needs to.
Yeah.
And like you said, I mean, they only average 40% possession a game, which is, again, you're really playing with fire here, especially in the Premier League. You can't sit and play on the back foot for 80% of your games. You just can't. So it's a tough one. It's definitely a tough one.
Yeah, but like we probably are concluding that they've obviously got a bit of a cushion as well. They've got 8 points, and I think their defense will allow them to sort of stay up. I don't, unless they go on, unless sort of the numbers revert to the mean or whatever, in terms of like the defense sort of becomes less efficient and does start conceding more goals and they drop down the table. I don't see that happening. They've got, what, there's 9 games left in the season. So I think they will survive this season, but there's a lot of work for Steve Bruce to do for next season. If they want to sort of move up the table and not be involved in a relegation battle every year. So yeah, that's what we basically think about Newcastle. And moving quickly along to the next team on the list, which is Aston Villa. And again, Aston Villa are, I wouldn't say they're a curious team, but I think a lot more was expected from them when they got promoted, especially after the amount of money that they spent. Depending on the source you use, they probably spent the most amount of money in the league, or easily in the top three over the summer. Probably only United and City have spent more, or competitive amounts, over 100 million. I think about 150 million or so, 140 odd million pounds is what Villa spent in the summer. And they spent a bit in the winter window as well. But that doesn't really seem to have helped them too much, because they're 19th and they're 2 points off safety at the moment. But it's not been a good season in terms of results, but they have been extremely unlucky as well, because they've suffered a bunch of injuries to some of their most important players. Tom Heaton and Wesley, I think they got injured in the same game and they're both out for the season now. So Heaton obviously robs them of that commanding presence in the back. He just joined the club in the summer from Burnley and they lost him, I think, somewhere towards the end of September or October, I think. And Wesley, who was the big sort of summer signing they made in terms of this big number nine up front, he got injured as well. So till the January window opened, they were literally without any other strikers, because they didn't have any other strikers in the squad. So they were playing with Anwar El Ghazi was playing as a false nine at times. Jack Grealish played there a couple of times. So they were doing without a striker for the best part of 2 months or even more before the January window opened. And they finally got Samata in January from Club Brugge. But they've also, even John McGinn, who was so good. Like, I remember watching Aston Villa versus Spurs on the opening day of the season, I think it was, when they beat them. And they were just, John McGinn was absolutely superb on that day. And he has been superb for Villa both during the promotion campaign and this season, for as long as he was playing before he got injured as well. Because what has happened is, before we delve into the tactics as well, and there is going to be a lot of talk about Jack Grealish here, because Villa are probably the most one-man team in the league, maybe bar Crystal Palace, who rely maybe as much on Wilfried Zaha, but Villa rely an inordinate amount on Jack Grealish. But before we get to that, what's happened with John McGinn's injuries is that their midfield has had to be restructured a little bit, where earlier it was, if they played a 4-1-4-1 or a 4-3-3, but basically with like three midfielders in the center, it'd be Douglas Luiz sort of as the anchor, and you'd have Jack Grealish and John McGinn as the two central midfielders, where Grealish was basically like a floating sort of number 10 or inside left midfielder in that sense, and McGinn would be on the other side and he'd provide the drive and the energy and be the box-to-box player. But with McGinn's injury, they've been playing Marvelous Nakamba quite a bit, who is a lot more defensive than Luiz. So while you would think for a side like Villa, it would actually be a benefit for them to have sort of two defensive minded midfielders in there with Luiz and Marvelous Nakamba, but what the composition of the midfield has changed all in this also because Grealish has actually been playing on the wings for the majority of the season. He's not played in centre mid, I think, for a good 3 months now. He's been playing as a left winger, where in the middle now they've played with those two, and at times Conor Hourihan has played. They got Danny Drinkwater in on loan during the January window. He's played a few games, but obviously he's not really pulled up any trees there. But Grealish has not really played in his favoured central attacking midfield position. It's been those two and a third, or if they've gone with two midfielders at times when they've played with a back three, it's robbed them of a lot of creativity and impetus through the centre of the pitch. And another interesting thing from a tactical point of view is also that Dean Smith switched to a back three somewhere around September and October, and they've actually had some of their worst results. And in terms of goals conceded, at least, have been when they've played with a back three or a back five. If you were to look at the sort of split between the formations that they've played and the XGA per 90, I won't look at goals per at the sort of raw goals against numbers because they've not really played a lot of these formations for a lot of time. But in totality, if you were to look at all of the formations they've played where they've played with a back three or a back five, their XGA per 90 for that entire period of time is over 2.5. It's close to 2.6, 2.7 expected goals per 90, which is a huge number, where it's basically telling you that when they've played with the back three, they've the numbers tell you that they should have conceded 3 goals a game, close to 3 goals a game, which is ridiculous because that system, Dean Smith literally turned to that system to provide more stability and more security for his centre back, for his goalkeeper, and for his team as a whole. But that didn't really work out. And a lot of it, I think, more than tactics, is also down to the personnel that he has. Villa have seen a lot of churn over the summer, where Tyrone Mings was the only centre back who was there the previous season. Bjorn Engels came in, Courtney House, Ezri Konsa, they were all either. I think House came back on loan from loan, so he wasn't there the previous season, and they bought Ezri Konsa as well. So all of them are new to the club, and they've sort of had, it will take time for a centre back partnership to gel. And Smith has had to chop and change his partnerships at the back as well. So it's not like there's been a settled one, although I think they've found a more settled one now with Engels and Mings, which looks like the sort of the preferred partnership going into the last 8 or 9 games of the season. But at least for the period of time when they were playing that back three, they were all over the place defensively. And since they've shifted back to a back four, they've actually got some decent results. They gave Man City a decent, I wouldn't say they gave them a fight in that sense, but they've managed to hold Man City off for quite a while in the League Cup final as well, in the Carabao Cup final. And with the back four, whenever they've played it, they've basically played it where they collapse into a deep block. They don't really press up front, like they barely press, I'd say. Their pressing numbers, if you were to look at that, are probably around 14, I think. Their PPDA for the season is around 13.5, 14, which is not a lot. And especially against the big teams, they sit back a lot more. So what was astonishing, when I was doing my research for this, for the League Cup final, their PPDA was at 18.5, and for the entire game. But at certain points of time during the game, it was as high as 63. They were allowing the opposition to make 63 passes at one point of time before they got the ball back, So that just tells you how passive they were. But it works to an extent against a side like Man City, for example. When you compress space both vertically and horizontally and basically set up camp just outside your box, defend the width of the box with your back four, and then you have your midfield line, whether it's a four or a five, maybe about 5 yards or at the most 8 or 10 yards ahead of them. I think even 8 or 10 yards would be a little bit too much. You'd probably shorten that distance. And you don't allow them any space centrally. You're content as a side for them to shuffle the ball from right to left in front of your defensive block, and you're okay with them sort of going down to the touchline and setting crosses in because you have the defenders to head crosses away. And Villa certainly have that. Mings is a physical specimen. He's like, what, 6'4" or something. So you're rarely going to beat him in the air. Engels is pretty good in the air as well. So Villa, at least from a defensive point of view, against the bigger teams, their tactic of sitting deep, denying space centrally, and allowing the opposition to get, down the wings and get to the touchline and send crosses in works to an extent. Obviously, the quality of the better sides does come through eventually at times, which it did in that League Cup final as well. But I think that is the template they need to follow against the big teams, if not other teams, especially against the top six sides. I'd say they just need to concentrate on defending as deep as possible and denying space both in behind the defensive line as well as right in front, where they might, denying space in the half space basically. So from a defensive point of view, I think that sort of the Carabao Cup final performance sets the template for them to go into the last 8 or 9 games of the season. But from an offensive point of view, I think it literally is all we can talk about is Jack Grealish, because he is literally single-handedly carrying the club from an offensive point of view. If you look at all any statistic to do with Grealish, he's up there with the best in the league. For example, I think he's created the most chances from open play this season. And if you were to look at chances created overall, he's, I think, second or third in the list behind Trent Alexander-Arnold and Kevin De Bruyne. For another interesting stat, which is passes completed, passes into the penalty area, open play, he's third or he's fourth on the list. So there's De Bruyne, Alexander-Arnold, and Wilfried Zaha who are ahead of him. But I think because he's not really played as many full games as the other players, if you were to look at it on a per 90 basis, I haven't done the calculation yet, but if you were to do that calculation, he'd probably be second, or maybe I think he'd be second or third on that list as well, in terms of passes into the penalty area per 90. So he is the sort of creative heartbeat of this side. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, because he's created close to 25% of the chances for Villa overall in the league. And while you might think that that is a bad thing from a point of view that they are overly dependent on him, Kevin De Bruyne is at a similar percentage for City. He's created 25% or close to 25% of chances for City as well. And it's just sometimes a reflection of the quality of the player, but obviously also it does impact the team as well when that particular player is not doing well. And we've seen that with City as well, when De Bruyne has not been available, that they have struggled to create chances at times. And that is the case with Villa as well. Grealish, as I said previously, he has played a lot more on the wing than in his sort of favored number 10 or inside left position. He's played on the left wing a lot. And what that does is, tactically, while it allows him to link up with Matt Target, who is a sort of attacking fullback who does try and get up the pitch to support him, it doesn't give him too much room to play. I mean, I wouldn't say play passes, but basically, because he's out on the touchline, there's one side of the pitch which is completely obviously closed off, which is the touchline. So he's forced, and being a left-footed player on the left flank, it's not like he tries to come inside as much as he can, but it's not like it's his favored side. He's much more comfortable playing in the central pockets, in those half spaces which form between the opposition center back and center midfielder, or the opposition fullback and the center midfielder and the center back. That sort of triangle of space that forms is where he thrives in. But he's not had the chance to play there as much as he would like, because he's had to play on the left wing. And he's happy. I mean, obviously, he's a team player, he's the captain, so he does that. But he said so in an interview, I think, to Sky Sports, where he said that he obviously prefers to play on that in that inside left channel, if you want to call it. So, yeah, Villa, from an attacking point of view, have been absolutely reliant on Grealish. And if I was to look into the stats as well, he had a little bit more into the stats for Grealish. He had what I think he scored 9 goals and has 6 assists this season. If you look at the goal involvement rate, that's about a goal involvement of every 178 minutes, either a goal or an assist, which is great. That's like a goal or an assist every 2 games, which is phenomenal, I'd say, for a side like Villa to have that sort of contribution from one player. But he really needs some of his teammates to come up and support and help him out. And Samata, who is the central striker they signed, has sort of, I mean, I wouldn't say he's taken the creative burden away, but what that does is he's given Villa that sort of direct option back, which they didn't have when they were playing without Wesley and without, obviously, they hadn't signed Samata. So when they were playing with El Ghazi and Grealish as like false nines, they didn't have the option to play a long pass out or a long ball out and the number nine to hold it up and for his midfielders or even the fullbacks or whatever who would support him. They didn't have that option, which is, I think, crucial for a side like Villa who play with a deep defense. You need an out ball, basically, someone who can hold up the ball and allow your teammates to get up on the counter attack. And with Samata, they've managed to get that sort of option back where they can play long balls out towards him and he can hold up the ball for the likes of Grealish and El Ghazi to get forward, and he can play the ball to them and, you know, carry out a counter attack. So that is another thing where I think, obviously, coming into a new league, he will take time to settle, but he does offer them that physical option up front. But it remains to be seen. I think it's a really tight race down at the bottom, and I think they don't have enough to survive. They're too reliant on Grealish, and they just don't have enough quality up front, I'd say, to be able to survive. I think they will get relegated. It'll be really close. I think it'll come down to the last day. But yeah, I don't think Villa are going to survive based on their tactics and the way they've played this season. It's going to be really difficult for them. Because again, if you look at the expected goals and all of that, they're performing where the XG should be. You know, they've scored 34 goals. The XG is at 34.8. They've conceded 56 goals. The XG against is 61.5. So they've done well on that regard. They've conceded five and a half or goals bet less than what the numbers would suggest. But I don't think that's good enough. They've certainly not scored enough goals, I think. And unless they can manage to, although it is tight, you know, if they can either run off two, maybe even three victories, that might just be enough for them to climb out and stay, you know, out of the relegation zone. But it remains to be seen. My opinion, at least, is that they
That's
probably will go down,
no, that's
maybe just by
interesting.
the skin of their
I
teeth,
totally
maybe, but
agree.
I
I
don't think
think
they'll be able to
Villa's
survive.
problem has always has been their attacking issues. At least, like we talked about with Newcastle, that they've got two, three players that they can kind of rely on in like the Almiron and Saint-Maximin, and you know the odd person comes up. But it just seems like with Villa, it's Grealish or nothing. You know, Samata has shown, like you said, he's shown flashes of brilliance. You know, especially you know, like in the League Cup final, he scored and all that. And I think, like you said, defensively, if they can kind of play like the way they did in the League Cup final, they may have a chance. But it's almost weird. It's like Villa have the opposite problem. I don't want to say opposite problem, but like Villa's problem is more like they're a bit too open, you know, like defensively, whereas Newcastle are a bit, while they are leaking goals as well, you know, while they are leaking goals as well, but Newcastle play with this really compact five at the back. We're gonna close the
Oh yeah,
spaces, we're gonna
absolutely.
try and keep a compact, you know.
Absolutely. Newcastle are a much better drilled side than Villa. And a lot of that, I think, is the legacy of Rafa Benitez because it was a similar system that he was playing when he was there last season.
Yeah.
So I think the Newcastle players haven't really had to adapt to a new system because Steve Bruce has used that, you know, with the three centre backs and the wing backs. But, excuse me. But Villa, there've been some horrendous errors at the back. Like, I remember, I think a couple of weeks, not weeks, but like a couple of game weeks ago, whenever I think it was Villa were playing Leicester, and Pepe Reina just like came screaming out of the box for a pass, which was he didn't need to. His defenders were coming back as well, and completely missed it. And the player, I forget who scored for Leicester, but whoever the player was, he had an open goal for you know, to score, and they won the game like by a huge amount. So yeah, they've made a lot of defensive
Definitely.
errors, and I think that that's probably what will cost them towards the end of the season. So yeah, that was what we thought of Villa. And moving on to the last team for this episode and for the series as a whole, we are gonna have a look at Bournemouth.
So
So
Bournemouth again. So I was looking
Abdullah,
a
what do
few
you think?
clips and
How
kind of
have
I'm
they
kind of I
been
might be
from
you
a
know
defensive point of
chomping
view?
at the bits and harping on the same thing, but it seems to me like a lot of these relegation threatened sides have almost the same issue. It's sloppy defending. Bournemouth again, Eddie Howe, love the way he operates, love the fact that he loves to play out from the back. You know, he's got some positive football, and I think out of the all the relegation sides, him and Graham Potter at Brighton have like some of the better football styles, you know, for the lower half of the table. But It's just, some of the goals that they gave away, like I was looking at clips against Liverpool and other teams. It's just poor passing. Like a little bit more concentration, getting the ball from the center back to midfield would have been better. And they could have avoided a goal, whereas, they gave basically gifted a goal away, and then Mohamed Salah had scored and closed it out. So for me, that's what it is. And against Chelsea, they were just coming under relentless pressure, and that's how Alonso got his second goal. Obviously, it was a little bit unlucky because it was a shot into the keeper. Ramsdale saved it, and then Alonso followed up with a header. But Bournemouth, again, if they can cut out the silly mistakes in giving the ball away, again, I think that would get help their chances. I think it's just un I think it's un it's I think it's more from a I think it's definitely, obviously they need to fix something defensively, but I think up front, like what you will talk about is definitely where they have suffered as well. Now, if I look at their stats, they're conceding 1.54 goals per 90 minutes in the league, which is 1.5 goals. You round it up, it's almost 2 goals a game, which is quite a bit, all things considered. They have about 13.86 shots taken against them, with 37% on target, and they're taking 10.19 shots and with a 36% on target, which, all right, fine. I mean, that's almost 14 shots a game, so they're almost inviting pressure. Their defensive duels aren't as much as their opposition, 61 against 65. Aerially, though, so anything that comes over the top, they're able to deal with. They have 40.81, against them, and 40.78 that they have, which is, again, no, negligible in terms of the difference. So they are putting in a shift when it comes in the air. They've had 4.51 sliding tackles. So a lot of it, what it seems is teams are able to get in behind, and they're having to put in a lot of last ditch effort. I can't speak today for some reason. Last ditch effort, tackles to kind of get it away. And while only, 26% have been successful, whereas for the opposition isn't that much. So that's kind of where it is there. And again, 43 interceptions and 18 clearances. And they are giving away 10 fouls a game. Although quite surprisingly, it is, they have had 0.08 red cards averaged over the season. So it's something to worry about, I think, with them. It's a lot of giving the ball away, having to track back, make last ditch efforts, and kind of stop it from there. And I like their, I mean, Nathan Ake is a really good defender. I really like him. I do rate him. I think he's a good player. But I think the defense as a whole needs a refresh. I think they need a few new defenders. Chris Meppham's a good buy. He was a good buy, but I think he hasn't played as much as they'd want him to play. And overall, I think it's they can get away with the way they can get away with. I want to say they can get away with it because they've got the firepower potential to score more goals. But if they're not scoring goals and they're giving away goals like this, I think, again, if they can give away, if they can keep out the way they've conceded some of their goals in recent games, they have a chance. And I think they've got a better chance to stay up than some of the other teams if they, again, leave the sloppiness out of their game. What do you think?
I mean, defensively, you're right. They have been, I think, a lot more open than they've been in previous years. Like, I remember, I think this was about a year ago, I think, when for obviously the magazine that we put out on a monthly basis, the TFA magazine, I had done a piece, I think it was a year ago, because I think it was around December 2018 or January 2019, that issue, where I had looked at Bournemouth. And that time, basically a year ago, they were flying, they were doing really well. And I remember, I still remember, even though it's a year ago or whatever, where they're like, from the footage and all of that, where they were basically how I spoke about Villa, where it's extremely compact between the lines and both vertically, horizontally, all of that, not denying, sorry, denying space to the opposition to do anything centrally. And that was how they were playing last year. But for some reason this year, as you said, defensively, they've been all over the place. And I think there are two things, both defense, which have contributed to their downfall to an extent this season. Other things as well, but they've suffered, I think, through injuries as well, massively. They've had a bunch of players out. David Brooks, who was such a breakout star last season, has been injured for the whole of this season. I think I don't remember him playing this season at all. Jordan Ibe, sorry, Jordan Ibe's not really that important a player. I was thinking of Callum Wilson's been injured for a bit, where they've had to play Dominic Solanke instead, who's they paid a fair bit of money for him, but he's I don't think he's at Premier League level to sort of lead an attack. Josh King has been injured for some periods of time. They've not really had, even defensively, I think they didn't have Adam Smith, who's their right back for a while. Charlie Daniels is getting on as well in terms of age, and Diego Rico, who's been his replacement, is not really the best defensively. So that there has been a problem. They've suffered quite a bit with injuries, and I can't, I'm not recalling the other names right now, but I'm sure if you look it up, they've had a shocking injury list this season. So that has contributed a lot as to their problems. But secondly, I think the formation that they've played, which has been Eddie Howe's formation, he's, I think, always been playing a 4-4-2 or a 4-4-1-1. Apart from, I think there was a brief period of time last year when he was playing a 4-1-4-1, but other than that, it's that's been his template and his formation. And I'm not saying that that doesn't work. A 4-4-2 can absolutely work defensively. I think the best example of that, from if you were to look at football, continental or European football or whatever, Atletico Madrid, they've played a 4-4-2 under Simeone for, I think, as long as Simeone's been there. But you will, I think anybody will talk about them being one of the best sides defensively in Europe, if not potentially the world, right? So it's not as if the 4-4-2 formation itself can't be a solid defensive strategy, but it's the way they've used it this season, or the way they've implemented it this season, which has been a problem. Certainly offensively, where what has happened is that because they're playing a 4-4-2, it's a very sort of standard lines. Obviously, if you visualize it, the players are in like two straight lines, and then even the two strikers would ideally, they're in like a straight line, right? So whereas other formations have players naturally in positions where they are in a sort of in-between space between the lines, which obviously helps in terms of getting the ball forward. And I think Bournemouth have been literally too boxed or too straight in their attacking, in the sense that they've relied too much on passes down the wings, and they've not really had a lot of central penetration. Because what happens is that a standard attacking tactic, or not attacking tactic, I'd say, but a standard way of them building out from the back has been where the pass goes from one centre back to the other and then out to the full back. And ideally, then, when the full back has the ball, you should have a central midfielder coming close to him, offering support for him to be able to play a ball pass into that sort of central area or central channel. But the Bournemouth center midfielders have not done that a lot this season, whether that's because of lack of confidence, which is why they're not showing for the ball, or whether they're just not confident enough in general on the ball. Jefferson Lerma is one of the two midfielders, central midfielders who plays, and he's not exactly the best on the ball. But on the other hand, Philip Billing is quite good in possession, and he has the sort of strength and stature to be able to hold off opposition players as well. So I don't know why they've not done that, but basically they've struggled to create attacks down the center. So what that does is, when the fullback has the ball and he doesn't have a central midfielder giving him support, the only thing he can do is either play a pass down the line to the winger, or try and dribble up the pitch himself. And more often than not, because you obviously have the touchline with limits, which acts as a sort of barrier for you as an attacking player, it's an advantage for the defending player. More often than not, they've not been able to advance up the pitch, to be able to get the ball in dangerous areas. And even when they have done, it's been usually done down the wings. They've not had a lot of central possession. They've not had a lot of chances being created from central areas. And that's where they've struggled. The half space, which we talk about in tactics nowadays as being so important, is something that they've not utilized at all this season, at least not well, where players have not made the runs that you need to make in order to open up the half space for their teammates to come in and receive the ball. So even the wingers at times, when they've stayed wide when they should ideally be a little more central, and vice versa, they've not made the run out wide to open up the space centrally when they should be doing so. So it's been, I don't know whether it's, I wouldn't think it is something that's been being done by design, because Eddie Howe has shown that he's one of the brightest young coaches we have, you know, in the English league. And he's been like, he's extremely well drilled, and he puts his players in, there's a lot of information he gives them. And I would not think that this would be something that they're doing as part of a tactical, deliberate tactical instruction. I just think for whatever reason that they're not either not carrying out his instructions properly, or there's been some lack of communication, or they're just not motivated or confident enough to show for the ball. But whatever the reason is, the fact is that their attacking tactics have just basically made, it's been a lot of one-on-ones that have happened where their fullbacks don't have support, so they lose the ball, or the winger doesn't have a player making an overlapping run, or a player with whom you know he can play a 1-2 and run into space himself. Attacking players haven't had that. Strikers have been isolated at times, even though they're playing with two strikers up front, because their movement has just not been good enough to provide support for the player holding up the ball. So I think then you can maybe pin it on the system, in the sense that because it's a 4-4-2, you have these issues. But like I said, you know, I don't think it's the system as such that's the problem, because other teams have proven that you can do it defensively and certainly offensively. I think 4-4-2 is a very good strategy offensively, because teams aren't used to defending against two strikers nowadays. It's usually the one striker. Like if the opposition is playing two centre backs, they're used to marking just the one striker. It's very rare that teams play a 4-4-2, so both centre backs have a direct opposition to mark, which does create space for teammates, you know. So I think a 4-4-2 from an attacking point of view can work, definitely. If not defensively, it can certainly work from an attacking point of view. But that's where it hasn't worked. I think it's the formation, just the way they've used it hasn't worked. It's just been too much happening in straight lines and not enough being done between the lines. So unless they can manage to fix that, and obviously with like 8-9 games remaining, it remains to be seen whether they can do that. I don't think they will be able to. So it's going to be really difficult for them. They are what I think level on points. Yeah, they are level on points with sides above them at the moment, which are Bournemouth and West Ham. You know, they're all level on 27 points. They're just a goal difference that's keeping them in the relegation zone. So it's close. You know, they might just be able to stay out of it. They're 18th, right? No, sorry. They are in the relegation zone. My bad. They're 18th right now. So it again, as I said with Villa, you know, Bournemouth and Villa both are 50-50, I'd say, whether they're going to survive or not. It depends on how they play
over
the next nine games. Obviously,
you know,
their tactics.
I definitely agree.
If you were to just look at their tactics
and
come to a decision, I think
playing
Bournemouth and Villa,
their strikers just haven't been, you know, they just haven't turned up.
What
I mean, Callum Wilson and Joshua King were in such great form last year that they were high flying. They were scoring goals for fun, and Bournemouth were flying high, you know, in mid table and above. And like you said, I was just looking at the injury list, and there's about nine players here that are out for injury, and that's made a huge difference. Yeah, exactly. And it's made a huge difference for them. I mean, we look at some of the names.
From injury, right?
Yeah. I was just sort of saying, it's like it's Josh King, Lloyd Kelly, Charlie Daniels, David Brooks,
and
like you
also
said,
actually,
huge miss. Steve Cook, Simon Francis, Chris Mepham.
Sorry, go ahead.
I mean, these are just some of the names here that you see that were first team players last year that did so well for them, and now they've just been in and out of the side, whether it's long term injury, short term injury, stop start, doesn't help.
Yeah, and when you were talking about, you know, players not showing up, Ryan Fraser, you know, the biggest example, him and Brooks were like the two breakout stars in the entire league. Forget Bournemouth, you know, last year. Fraser was being touted for a move to, you know, Arsenal or Spurs or something this season. And he has said that because that move didn't come to fruition in the summer window, that he was distracted and he wasn't playing his best football for the last 6 months or whatever. And I think he said this after the January window closed, publicly in an interview or something, where he said that my mind's basically not been, I've been distracted. So that he's not been on form, which has been a massive loss for them as well. Because I think he was, again, those chance creation metrics and all that we spoke about earlier when you were talking about Jack Grealish, it was Ryan Fraser who was there in the top three for a number of those metrics last year, and he's just fallen off a cliff. I don't think he's got a. I'd be very surprised if he's got more than a couple of assists this season, even on and chances created and all of that. He's nowhere close to anywhere near the top of the table of those sort of charts and stats, you know. So they've lost that sort of that attacking sort of creativity from him as well, and he's out of contract in the summer. So if Bournemouth do get relegated, I think he will stay in the league. He'll probably get picked up by another side. But from an attacking point of view, again, they've lost a lot of directness and pace on the wings. And from obviously the fact that they've not had David Brooks and that Ryan Fraser has been completely off his game. And that, again, given that they've played down the wings mostly this year, they've not really had a lot of central penetration. And then to not have your first choice wingers is either, you know, either through injury or whatever, you know, they're distracted and all of that. That, again, points towards them just not being effective in attack. And Callum Wilson also had a breakthrough year last year. He got capped for England and all of that. But yeah, he's also fallen off in terms of form this year. I mean, nobody's talking about him being a part of the Euro squad now. Although, again, obviously with the Euros being postponed to next year, who knows what will happen over the whole of the coming season and what the squad will be like now for next year. But certainly, while the Euros were going to happen this year, there was no way Callum Wilson was getting into the England squad. While, you know, he was one of the backups for Harry Kane over the last, I'd say, what, year or so. So that again tells you that they've completely dropped off. And although, like you said, you know, they are one of the better sides, or they've been one of the better sides from an entertainment point of view. They've tremendous value. Eddie Howe always believes in like attacking football. And they've really played attacking football for during their time in the Premier League, even though they might not have been in the upper reaches of the table. I think it'll be a stretch for them to survive till, because they've got Watford, West Ham, Brighton ahead of them. And all three of those teams have started looking. Yeah.
You
and,
can never
and they're
trust
all
West
looking
Ham,
like,
though.
You know, better teams right now. Watford, certainly. West Ham have sort of looked better since David Moyes switched to a 4-4-2, and they've looked better offensively. They're scoring goals. No, of course, absolutely. And they're level on points, you know, so it's not like they're too far ahead. Brighton are just 2 points ahead of them, and West Ham, Watford and Bournemouth are all on 27. So I think it's going to be literally, it'll go down to the last day of the season. But on current form and on in terms of the tactics that they've employed this season, it'll take a lot for them to survive. It'll take one of the other teams to collapse or
agreed.
Not have, maybe have like a couple of bad games for Bournemouth to survive, unless they can, you know, pull something out of the hat for the last 9 games. But yeah, so I think that's it. We've looked at Newcastle, Bournemouth and Aston Villa today. And our assessment at least is that two of those three are going down. Newcastle aren't and the other two are. So let's see what happens, and let's see when it happens, to be honest. Who knows when the season is going to start, if it's going to start, if they're going to scrap it. All of those are obviously hypotheticals that are up in the air. But we're obviously talking as if the season will be completed and all the remaining fixtures will be completed. So that's the basis.
Appreciate
of,
it. Thank you for having
the
me
podcast
on.
That we're doing and the information that we're going on. But as and when things change, we'll see what happens. But yeah, it was great to have you on, Abdullah. Always, always a pleasure. Yeah. And for everyone out there, hope, as we said earlier, stay safe, stay inside. And hopefully we can get through all of this together. And hopefully we can have football back on, because as much as you love to talk about it, analyze it, write about it, read about it, all of that, I don't think there's a substitute to actually watching the game or playing the game if you play the game. So hopefully football comes back on soon. And we will be back next week with another episode. Although, to be honest, at the moment, I don't really know what we're going to talk about. But we'll come up with something to talk about. There is always enough to analyze. So we will come up with something to talk about, and we will be back next week with next week's episode. And as I said, do check out the other podcasts we have. Obviously, Abdullah leads the women's football podcast, and he does lead the sort of women's football content that we put out on Total Football Analysis and our development site, Football Bloody Hell. So do check all of that out. Check out the other content we have on the website. As I said, the website is www.totalfootballanalysis.com. Our magazine just went on sale, I think 2 or 3 days ago, maybe about a bit longer than that. So check it out. it's got, it's our biggest magazine yet. We've got 29 articles in it. So if you want to give that a read, go to the website, see how you can get a hold of that. And yeah, let us know what changes you want us to make on the podcast or on in terms of our content. And we will try and get that done. But so yeah, till next week, stay safe, guys. Stay inside, sanitize, wash your hands, all of that. Keep listening to us and have a good one. See you guys. Bye.